Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Business Brew. This is Bill Brewster, your host. We are super fortunate to be joined with Sean Stannard Stockton, the CIO of Ensemble Capital. I'm looking very, very much forward to discussing his investment process. I think you're going to have your minds blown. Many of you already know him from Twitter. As a reminder, none of this is financial advice. We are not your financial advisors. We're not your fiduciaries. Do your own due diligence. Everything expressed here is opinion-based and is the opinions of Sean and I. Nothing is a invitation or a solicitation to buy or sell any securities. So please keep that in mind as you listen. Sean, how you doing?
Doing very well, Bill. It's been a pleasure to get to know you over the years, and very happy about your new podcast here. Listen to the first couple. They were fantastic, and glad to be here as a guest.
It's been a fun endeavor. I sort of am making a podcast that I think I would want to listen to, and it's been sort of fun to know that other people that I really respect like it too. So hopefully we can give them a good episode here. I'm sure we will.
Well, you know, Bill, really, that approach is how you should approach everything in business. Like, what is a product or a service or something that you would love and be passionate about? And that's what you go build and bring to the world, you know? And I would say everything about our investment strategy, while it's evolved over time, was us trying to figure out, how do we want to run money? What works for us? And if there's people out there that works for, that's fantastic, right? And to me, that's how you build great businesses and great offerings and services, is you build things around passion. And that's why so many companies are like founder-led companies that are so successful, because the founder was like, I believe in this, it needs to happen. And you built it, right? Look at Steve Jobs talking about, you know, focus groups. And don't use focus groups, people don't know what they want. You got to build what is wonderful and then hope people want it, right? And if you have that product market fit, people attack like that's like something that you have to go figure out what's needed and do it. No, you build something wonderful in the world and you hope to, you really hope it fits into the market.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask you a somewhat tough question here. Did you stumble into a wonderful product in Ensemble, or did you really take over and build it? I don't know much about the person that you joined to join the firm, but you were employee too, right?
I was, yeah. Like, just like many people who build something, there was some very big stroke of luck and then hard work mixed in to lead to where you got to. So, you know, I was like the prototypical, you know, 13-year-old kid who read a book about stock picking. My father was a sociologist, a professor. My mom was a psychologist. Mm-hmm. They weren't interested in Wall Street in the least. And I came across this book. I won't even mention its name. It was a terrible book. It was awful advice, but I didn't care. I was a 13-year-old, right? It was like a get-rich-quick scheme sort of stock-picking book. But it set me on this journey. And, you know, I went to college and got an econ degree. And I graduated in the late 90s and went right into, you know, the investment world. And then through a kind of a series of moves, was introduced to the founder of Ensemble Capital, a man named Kurt Brown. And he was managing about $60 million and some friends and family money. And he had a long career in Wall Street related jobs. And he was in his 60s when he founded what was then Curtis Brown & Company in 1997. And I joined him in 2002. And I think we had like 15, 16 clients, something like that. And we built it from there. And Kurt was somebody who very much recognized that he wanted to build a team, a group, a firm, right? It wasn't just him. And so about 18 months after I joined him, he said, "Hey kid, let's go into this together. Let's make this a partnership." And we renamed the company Ensemble Capital, and I took a small ownership stake. And at that point, you know, I was a glorified operations person, right? You know, but we built it from there.
What, I mean, I think I know, but why Ensemble?
You know, like naming anything, you go through lots of different things. And we had lots of ideas that, you know, thought, hey, this will be great. And we mentioned some. I said, oh my, here's this problem with it, whatever, you know. And Ensemble was kind of, it came out of the blue. It was a car ride my wife and I were having. And I knew somebody was working at another asset management company that had a kind of a musical name to it. And we thought of Ensemble. But Ensemble means a group of people or things deliberately put together to work in harmony. And to me, that's what a portfolio is all about. And that's what a business is all about. And so, you know, it kind of fit. It just seemed like an obvious one once we named it.
Something that I think has been really cool to watch about your firm over the last 3 years is you are almost set up for COVID without even knowing it, because you guys are all distributed geographically, right?
Yeah, I mean, that too was, you know, just something kind of happenstance in a way. So we were not. I mean, it was maybe, I guess, about 3 years ago or so, 4 years ago. We were all 100% in the office and everything, and we just, you know, the traffic in the Bay Area is terrible, right? And mm-hmm. every year the commutes got longer and longer. And I think we interviewed somebody who lived in San Francisco and our offices are in Burlingame, which, you know, once upon a time was like a 20-minute drive down the 101 down the peninsula. And it's, you know, these days it could be an hour, or pre-COVID, it could be, you know, an hour during traffic. And the person was like, well, it just seems like too long of a commute. And we're like, gosh, if we can't hire people in San Francisco, how are we? I mean, like, that's just the city up the street, right? And
yeah.
And so we started doing remote, and we started off one day a week. Just saying anyone wants to can work one day a week. And then it was 2 days a week. And then we were kind of like, this is working great. And so, you know, I think it was maybe 2.5 years ago, we told people, look, just work where you need to work to get whatever work you're doing done. That's where you need to work. This isn't about, you know, what do you write? It's not a perk for the staff, right? It's about work where you need to work to get the most work done, you know? And that quickly kind of evolved to about 40% office occupancy. And you know, client facing people are in the office more. The research team, Todd and RF's analysts don't have a lot of need to be in the office or anything like that. And so then we started hiring some full-time remote people. And so we went into COVID, with, you know, I think maybe 2 people full-time remote, and other people, you know, had the desks, but they weren't in there all that much or anything. But on March, I think it was 16th, we flipped the switch and just turned off the office. Right. And I had some worries about, like, can we onboard new clients and all that sort of stuff. But we've actually had our best year in our history in terms of new client growth, new asset growth, and so everything's working well. But it sure helps that, you know, the whole client world got a crash course in Zoom as well, right? And so once upon a time we might have been able to do it, but our clients wouldn't have been able to do it,
yeah.
right? And now everyone's able to do it, and so it's very quick, and we've actually onboarded 2 full-time remote employees since COVID started. I've never met them in person, and it's moving great, works really well. And you just realize how many of the trappings of life that you took for granted aren't always needed. And yet there's some that's super critical. I mean, post-COVID, humans are social animals. People are gonna get back together again, no doubt about it.
Yeah, I think that's right. What have you encountered just running a business, onboarding? I mean, I know you said that the onboarding process has gone well, but have there been any challenges that you as an operator have had to overcome? How'd you figure out, like, bringing an employee on? How do you get them up to speed and meeting the team? Is Zoom a sufficient way to introduce people to the team, or does it create its own sort of, I guess, hardships, or I don't know if that's even the right word, but you know what I'm asking, right?
I mean, I think like anything, it has some things that are better and easier and some things that are harder and more challenging, right? And I think that the most important thing about remote work is that if you have a remote work employee, but the firm is not a remote first firm, it's got big problems. They're always going to be kind of like second class citizens. I interviewed an analyst before we were a remote work firm, and the analyst, she was the only remote analyst on her team. And she was saying, you know, it's like little things, like there's birthday cake in the break room on everyone's birthday, except for the remote person, right? Mm-hmm. And their birthday just gets skipped. And it's not a big deal, but those things cumulatively create a culture in which the remote employees are secondary or separate from the kind of the real team in the office, you know? And so when I hear these CEOs of big companies saying, well, the whole executive team is going back to the office, but remote, you know, everyone else, you can work remote if you want to. All those top performing employees are going to, what they hear is that the top performers are in the office. Right.
Yeah.
And if you want a career path, you will go into the office too. And so to me, it's really about if remote work actually works for your firm, which it will not for everybody, then it should be a firm-wide commitment. And there's no reason why a senior person would need to be in the office any more than a junior person, unless, of course, the day-to-day tasks require in-person activity for the senior executive, you know. And so, you know, yes, of course, there's challenges, but there's other things that are faster and better, you know, and gosh, you got to have a staff that can write well and write fast and feels fluent in that way, you know? And so I'm sure that there's certain employees who would not thrive in this sort of environment, but our team, it seems to be doing great. And we also do intentionally a lot of social stuff. I mean, it's been hard to figure that stuff out, you know, but that's important, right? So we have a whole dedicated social chatter kind of, you know, we don't use Slack, we use something else, but something similar to that, you know, that's one of the most vibrant communication channels, you know, and we really go out of our way to celebrate, you know, each other and what they're doing, hearing about each other's kids, and none of that stuff changes just because you're remote, you know?
Yeah. I've wondered coming out of this, I've heard some people say that you know, the smaller businesses that I talk to occasionally, maybe 15 employees or less, right, talk about like going completely remote. And the question that I've had is, how are you going to handle the junior people that you onboard? Because I think that to me is like the real risk. There's a lot, I say it in family times a lot, quantity of time turns into quality of time. And I feel like the workplace is very similar. It's going to be interesting to see how everything sort of evolves coming out of this.
Yep. If the managers are all in office and the new junior people are remote, you got a huge problem, right? But there's nothing that a junior person's missing if their manager is remote, right?
Yeah.
If the junior person's remote, you know, and so, you know, I think that, you know, for this audience, of course, what's most relevant is the investment team, the research team here, and how they're operating remote. And so, you know, to me, when we hired Todd Wenning, who's one of our analysts, who was our first full-time remote employee, he lives outside Cincinnati. At the time, RF, who now lives down the San Diego area, but at the time lived in Silicon Valley, where I live and where the firm's headquarters are. One of the reasons we hired Todd was to bring somebody on who wasn't in the Silicon Valley bubble. And you know, just a quick story about that. You know, we owned Starbucks at the time, we still do, you know, everybody I knew was talking about mobile ordering and rewards and digital, and Starbucks is killing it. And Todd's like, you know, drive-thrus are super important to the business model. I was like, what are you talking about? There's no drive-thrus around here, you know? and he's talking, and he's right, you know, yeah. He's talking about, you know, you install a drive-thru in a Starbucks that needs a drive-thru, of course, and you know, significantly increase profitability and everything. And what Starbucks talking about, you know, this whole year, we're putting in drive-ins all through the Midwest and the Southeast, and this is a huge lift. And they just talked about their investor day a day or two ago. And, you know, that's exactly right, right? But in Silicon Valley, there are no drive-thrus for Starbucks, right? And so that kind of cognitive diversity from having distributed workforce in the research team is an advantage for us, and one that I would never want to run money with a team of people all physically in the same geographic office all the time. I think you are at a deep disadvantage of your research team is all working out of one city from one office. They have too many of the same experiences, too many of the same, you know, networks they're part of, and there's going to become part of groupthink. So for me, that's one of the key advantages. And COVID only kind of didn't change any of that. We were already doing that as a research team.
Yeah, I thought that was super cool when you hired Todd. I'm, you know, got to know him through Twitter, as probably many listeners have, and you know, then when I found out he was from Ohio, I liked him even more because I have a Midwest bias. And then when you guys hired him and you said something about the fact that you wanted some geographical diversity, I mean, you know, I thought that was a very cool move by you to pick a Midwestern person as opposed to the East Coast, because, you know, the Midwest is honestly forgotten about a lot. And the way that I think Midwestern people look at the world, you know, they're not like an oppressed group or anything, but I do think that it's flyover country for a reason.
Yeah. So. Everybody has different experiences. And I think that's a critical part of any research process is for people to understand that the life experiences that you have inform the way you look at the world. Right.
Yeah.
And you cannot take those blinders off. You can do your best to kind of try and appreciate, have empathy for other points of view and incorporate that. I mean, we own companies that sell stuff that I'm not a customer of, and that's okay. I'm not looking to buy companies that make the stuff for me. Like we started the interview talking about build processes, your products you're passionate about, right?
Yeah.
As an investor, it's not just finding things that I'm passionate about or Todd's passionate about. It's about finding companies that sell something that have a match in a passionate way with their customer base, whoever they might be, you know? And so having people with different life experiences and backgrounds is key.
So when you're doing research on a company like that, that maybe you don't have, you know, personal connection with or whatever, isn't completely in your direct circle of competence, so to speak, how do you get comfortable with, are you doing surveys of their customers? Are you talking to their customers? Like, how are you getting into their customer's mind?
Gosh, it can be so different.
Yeah,
for every
kind
sort
of generic
company,
question,
you know,
isn't it?
And
sorry.
No, it's not a generic question. It's just a different answer for every single company, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, I know that, for instance, I personally have had a lot of interest and success in investing in B2B companies and B2B kind of like software service providers. And they're often kind of undercovered by investors, unless, of course, they're kind of like brand new SaaS B2B businesses in which they're overcovered, right? But I mean, if you're talking about, you know, a lot of businesses that are they're just not a little bit kind of invisible in the grand scheme of things, you know, and yet many of them have this attribute that creates fantastic competitive advantage, which is offering some sort of product or service to the other business that's the customer that is mission critical to the functioning of that company, but which is a super low portion of the overall cost structure, right? Yeah. So if you look at a business like Paychex that we've owned for a number of years, and so if you as a company, the customer, right, the business that is the payroll customer of Paychex, if they don't process payroll correctly, they have an instantaneous crisis on their hands, right? I mean, you know, employees are not like, oh, no big deal, it's just a little bit of an error. You know, it's like it has to be right 100% of the time, right? Yeah. And the IRS gets really rather pissed off if if you don't, you know, withhold correctly and everything, right? And so this is like mission critical, but it's also something that the company wants to forget about. You just don't want to think about payroll. It just wants to get done, right? Yeah. And no one would ever say like, well, my payroll gets done extra special well. No, there's just a threshold. It needs to get done 100% correct all the time.
Yeah, it's either right or it's wrong. We're pretty binary here.
Yeah, right. But there's not like high-end payroll, right? Yeah. It's like it is what it is, right? And so if you look at business like Paychex, if somebody comes along and says to the customer, right, the customer that's buying the service from Paychex and says, listen, hey, we can do it for free and just as good, right? And then you talk to the kind of head of HR. The head of HR says, it's going to be great, it'd be free, you know, and you say, well, guess what? It won't even show up as a rounding error on our financial statements, the money that we're going to save.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, but we might as well save the money. But could there be any issues, right? Well, I mean, like maybe we have a couple weeks of problematic payroll or somebody's bonuses didn't get processed correctly and, oh, it'll be a ton of work for HR. And well, why are we doing this then? Right, just stick with what works, you know? Yeah. And so that can also lead to these B2B service providers becoming kind of almost exploitive businesses, right? Where they're like, hey, no one pays attention to us. Let's just keep jacking up prices and we won't invest in our product. And over time, they mortgage their moat, this phrase that we talk about, right? Where you take steps that make it look like you're getting more and more profitable, things are great, but really you're creating negative goodwill with your customers, right? By not investing in the product and overcharging it for the service, but nobody really cares because it's such a small price until one day people wake up and say, this is ridiculous, right? Yep. And you lose tons of customers. So you'd be very careful of that, right? But when you have these companies that are mission critical at a low cost and they continue to improve the product and make it better and they do all that, you can create very sticky, very sustainable, super lucrative, high return on invested capital businesses. And so here I'm getting off track raving about these businesses, but you asked about the customers and how we get to know them, right? And so I've always thought like these aren't that hard to understand. And but somebody a while ago was like, yeah, but Sean, you've been involved in building and running a business and it's a small one, right? And it occurred to me that that's true. Like some of these things are they just kind of make sense to me, you know, and running a 15 person firm does not mean that I'm an operator and that I understand these things at a high level. But I think that trying to just put yourself in the shoes of, you know, if you are a manufacturer and you're working with Fastenal, a business that we own, and they're supplying things to you and understanding about, you know, that they're carrying kind of inventory for you off your balance sheet and getting it to there just in time. All this stuff just kind of makes intuitive sense to me personally, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas RF on our team has a huge interest in biotech and science and you know, he went to MIT and initially he was going to be an astrophysicist before he discovered economics, you know.
Oh, wow.
And so he has a passion and interest in understanding the science behind a lot of this stuff that I'm like, that's not my interest. I can read it, process it, do my best to understand it, you know. And so I think everyone on the team has different companies that they have more interest in. And yeah, of course, we can talk to customers or, you know, read surveys, reach out to stuff. But if we feel like we are that distant from being able to understand it, we'd probably move on to something else.
That makes sense. I got to ask you about a hot button company. You talked about B2B and a low portion of cost. And I know in the past you have had an affinity for TransDigm and it's such a controversial name. How do you reconcile those two thoughts? I own it. So I think that I'm closer to your camp than what sort of the people that would argue that it's an exploitative business would argue. Probably the most, I guess cogent's the word I'm looking for, argument that I've heard is what you said, that they deliver on time service for the airlines. But I'm just interested to sort of hear you wax poetic about it, if you don't mind.
So we owned TransDigm for many years, and we fully exited the position in January or February this year, not with any foresight about the virus, the pandemic. We exit it for valuation reasons, and sometimes it's a lot better to be lucky than good. Now, I know the stock's come back dramatically, but it fell, and it would have been, you know, it was an existential, like everyone's been talking about their debt levels. And well, this was the event. This was the event that should have killed TransDigm, that everyone said was going to kill TransDigm, right? And everyone said, I said, hey, look, you know, the sustainability of passenger miles, and it's going forever. And then this year happens, right? And so as a reminder, this year is a great reminder, and TransDigm is a great reminder that like things that have never happened before do happen, right? And this was one of those. We are long HEICO now, and for anyone who follows the kind of TransDigm and HEICO, it's like, you know, the dark side and the light side. You know, HEICO's the good guy, and TransDigm's the evil one. And but while we own TransDigm, and you know, our view is that the customers are the airlines, not the people, the shorts, the politicians who complain and say that TransDigm's ripping off other people, right? The airlines, certainly you can find quotes, people saying, gosh, they charge a lot. But this is not an industry, a company that is like constantly badgered by their actual customers saying, you're really screwing us here, you know? And the fact is that it is really important that somebody keeps making these products that have been, you know, designed and effectively kind of out of production, or they're still being produced, but I mean, like, you know, it's for a airline platform that's no longer in production. And like, these are older things, right? And so one of the ways I thought about it is, you know, when I go down to the local Ace Hardware and I want to buy like a screw that fits a particular thing, and my house was built almost 100 years ago, right? So I got to find this kind of odd screw or whatever. And they have this huge rack at Ace Hardware with all these different screws, right? And I find it and I buy one and it's 15 cents, right? Well, it's like a penny of metal. But I don't sit there and say, they are crushing me on the profit margins here. This is outrageous, right? So you have like 85% profit margins here. So who cares? Yeah. What am I really paying for with that 15 cents? I'm paying Ace for the service of maintaining this inventory, having it available, getting it to me just as I need it, right? It is. If you look at the product margins, you're paying attention to exactly the wrong thing. That's not what's going on here. They're not selling you the product, right? They're selling you the solution to your problem, and they're maintaining inventory of those solutions for you, right? And so that's kind of how I think about TransDigm, is that they do this work that nobody else wants to do, right? And they maintain all this stuff, and they get it there just in time. And so to me, much of the complaints were somewhat, you know, kind of not appreciating what was actually being bought and sold in the situation, you know. All that being said, we had many debates about this exact same issue. It's a controversial stock, and we don't own it anymore. But not because of this issue, you know. But it was one we talked a lot about. You know, the debate is a healthy and good debate.
I thought it was interesting when they were in front of Congress, and I thought that Howley's answer when somebody asked him about his margins, and he said, you know, look, if you want to go build the product, go build it, right? Like, we are not a cost plus designer of product like your typical government contractor. We are a commercial operator, and this is how the business works. You know, I don't know, that was a lot more what's the word? I mean, it was more convincing to me than things that I kind of went into that hearing skeptical. And when I listened to it and really process how he answered it, I said, you know, this actually makes a lot of sense, which was not what I expected. So another controversial stock that you've certainly been right on from a price perspective, I'm going to argue that you've been right for the right reasons, is Netflix. And currently is a pretty large holding in your portfolio. I have watched you over the years prove all the naysayers wrong, I think for the right reasons, and maybe you can help us figure out what everybody else is missing when they're focused on current free cash flow.
So let me just start off by saying I was one of the naysayers in the past. You know, one of the things that we do with idea generation is we don't pay any attention to valuation at all as part of the deciding what are we going to go look at. My view is that if you can actually value and have a sense of intrinsic value before you've decided to do the work on a company, like, what are we all doing all day, right? And so the idea that people, before they do the work, could look and say, well, it's really expensive, let's look at it later, it's not worth looking. Like, how could that be? The market's pretty efficient, right? Like, well, it's challenging to outperform the market, which means that most of the time, most stocks are trading kind of close to fair value, right? Yep. At least that should be your default assumption, even if they appear on the surface to look like they're overvalued or undervalued, you know, and so we don't we don't think about valuation when we first look at things. And I and the other analysts all try and, you know, bite our tongue when someone else on the team starts looking at something that maybe we don't think's a good idea, because that's the whole point of having this cognitive diversity, is different people have different ideas, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Arif was the one who started looking at Netflix. He'd followed it way before he joined Ensemble. But all I could remember was when they sold shares, and then they had the whole blow up with Flickster and everything, and then they bought back shares like 150 or something. They held Flickster, then they had to sell shares, and to me I was like, well, these guys are the worst capital allocators in the world, right? But this is one of these. I mean, I wasn't even following the story. It was like I read a headline. It's like, I don't even need to pay attention to them. They're terrible capital allocators. I don't have to think about this anymore. Horrible thing to do, right? Huh. But it was one of those cognitive biases, right? And so I brought that up to Arif, and he was like, yeah, but it was the right thing to do to issue those shares, right? Look what they've done. They made a mistake, and then they corrected that mistake probably faster than most companies ever correct mistakes.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's exactly right. Like, what do I want more than anything from a management team? Because they're all going to make mistakes, every single one of them. I want a management team that recognizes and corrects these mistakes as quickly as possible. And so once I realized, I was like, well, maybe I've got this exactly wrong. Maybe this management team is fantastic, right? It's just that I saw them make a mistake and wrote them off, right? And so, you know, we started working on the name, and I think that the key insight that Arif had, and you know, other people talk about pricing power. I'm not suggesting this is like our own, you know, no one else is talking about this, but the key thing that when he was looking at it, explained to me that we as a firm, this is, you know, we all believe this, is that the company is underpricing their product versus what it's worth in the market. And if you think about how kind of a traditional tangible asset brick and mortar companies kind of thing grows, is you grow via CapEx. When you invest into CapEx, and that gives you the opportunity to drive revenue. And GAAP accounting lets you say all that CapEx, it doesn't even count. It's not an expense. Let's just take it off the income statement. And only depreciation runs through it, right? And that's GAAP accounting. This is, it doesn't matter how old school you are. Everyone understands, yes, of course, big CapEx is not an expense, right? It's a future thing over time, but it's not an expense, right? And so, you know, we in the past, we've talked about how Home Depot had not only cash burn, negative cash, but accelerating negative cash burn all through its kind of early growth years. And by the time, it was also printed, you know, great EPS and had a PE of like 30, because GAAP accounting just let them just remove all of that, right? And so what we realized was that what Netflix was doing to grow was underpricing their product. But there's no accounting system, kind of rightly so, because it's like more art than anything you could quantify or account for, is that about how much are they discounting for? Nobody knows. They don't know, right?
Yeah.
But we believe that was correct, right? And so when we initiated on the name, we believed all of that. But it was a very small position because we weren't 100% sure. Could they really keep raising prices, you know? But, you know, over time, they've last, I think, 4 or 5 years, it's been like 8% CAGR on price, right? I mean, it's like, what big American company has been raising prices at 8% a year for the last 4 years in an inflation-free environment, right? I mean, this is crazy town, right? I mean, Apple's one, but no one's going to debate that Apple has pricing power, right? So, like, clearly, right, this there's something going on here. And then, you know, when you back into that, the big assumption we're making is an assumption around what it is the normalized, what is kind of the true price, market clearing price that they could move it to. And of course, if they flip the switch and did it today, they would lose some customers, right? But what is the price that is a sustainable price? And you have to pick your own number. You have to figure out what you think that is. And we've published some estimates of, you know, whether it's 15 or 17 or 20 or 25. And, you know, what is that number? I mean, I can tell you myself, right? Like, if I was going to lose access to Netflix, unless I pay like $50 a month, I'd be like, of course I'd pay $50 a month. It's the primary way my family watches television, right? I mean, the average American household watches 2 hours a day of Netflix.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's 60 hours. So $60 a month would be $1 an hour to watch TV, right? I mean, and you're still cheaper than cable television. And everybody was paying, you know, way over $60, you know, $50 a month for television, right? And so, so we don't assume they're going to charge $50. That's not the normalized price. But it's difficult to argue that where they price it now is somehow like, well, this is the right price. And so clearly to us, they're discounting it significantly. And so we think that they're going to be able to raise it over time, as they have in the U.S. You've seen their profit margins expanding dramatically in the U.S. as they reach maturity, and we think that's going to keep happening. And so, to us, that discount is like their CapEx, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have to understand that and think about how it plays out over time. But to us, the stock's cheap at 500. It's not expensive.
You know, what's been interesting to me through the pandemic is even when sports came back, they had a long, I don't know what ratings are doing now, but it seems as though it's at least possible that the pandemic has somewhat changed. I don't know if how much people value sports is the right way to frame what I'm saying, but it has been interesting that even when sports came back, people still seem to turn to streaming for their entertainment. And I don't know if it's because there weren't fans in the seats or it's not communal. I think there's a number of factors that could be contributing to that, but that has been a very interesting thing to follow from my perspective.
I think one aspect about the pandemic in the United States in particular is that kind of the overall shelter in place environment has persisted for a long time and is going to continue to persist for a while. And what that means is that habits are being formed and habits are hard to change, right? And so if you look at, imagine we had all gone back to work after 2 months and kind of life was back to normal. We would not have new habits. All this stuff about remote work here today, it would all just have gone back because people are like, well, that was just this weird event and now we'll go back to my old habits, right? But now you keep streaming, right? You keep playing video games with your kids, right? You keep using Zoom to talk to your family. You keep doing remote work. You actually bring on new employees who are full-time remote and you've never met them before. And all this stuff becomes habit.
Yeah.
And then the habit breaking is going back to how things used to be. And breaking habits is hard,
yeah.
Right? And so the pandemic and its impact in the United States persisting for as long as it has means that the habits to break are these new habits that we're all forming right now. So what's the relationship with sports? I don't know for sure, but I have to think that televised sports have lower relevance to American video consumers in the future than pre-pandemic, you know, and there's different ways to look at the data right now, but right now we just don't really know. There's so much changing, you know. I do think sports are certainly not going away. They play a critical role for a lot of people's lives, and they're, you know, I think there's a lot of kind of human DNA and genes that drive interest in sports, and but to your point, you know, NFL football is not what, you know, a lot of 16 and 17 year olds are thinking about. The main thing they want to watch on Netflix or YouTube or Amazon or anything.
Yeah. And to your point, like, let's say that the interest is in televised sports is even coming out of this as compared to 2019. I don't think that you can possibly make an argument that the interest has increased, right? So on a probability distribution, I think if you're relying on sports, you've got a negative skew to the assumption that you're relying on. I don't know how negative or whatever, but like to not at least adjust your brain that way, I think is not paying attention to reality.
Agreed.
How do you think through what Roku, I don't know if you do, but I guess that the Roku bulls would say, well, Roku's going to be the new bundler, right? And everybody else can sort of offer a substitute product to what Netflix can offer, right? So HBO Max, you got Viacom coming out with their thing, Discovery Plus, yada, yada, yada. How do you think through how Netflix sort of competes with those offerings for people's mind share?
Yeah. So relating that to the kind of the normalized price I talked about, right? So the price that people pay for things is not what it's worth to them, but a blend of what it's worth to them and the market clearing price. Right. Yeah. So we don't pay very much for water, but water is super important to us. Right.
Yeah.
And the reason we don't pay very much to water is not because it's not worth very much to us, but because of the market conditions. We can get it for cheap. So that's what we get it for. Right. And so just because something is valuable does not mean that it is going to be expensive, basically. Right. It depends on the market conditions. And that's why we care so much about competitive advantages. Right. And so you have all of this, you know, these, you know, HBO Max coming in and Disney Plus, and they were all supposed to kill Netflix. That was the whole deal, right? And just as a quick aside, all legacy media companies could have killed Netflix not all that long ago, right? They just made this huge mistake of thinking that it was incremental revenue for them. So they said, hey, well, this is great. Let's just sell the content we're selling already. Sell the second time to Netflix. How wonderful. And they fed the beast that's destroying them now, right? Yeah. It's just a classic mistake, right? I mean, it really surprises me that it actually played out that way. You know, you hear about different shows being pulled from Netflix and people say, well, it's going to kill Netflix. Well, it would have in the past, right? But now a lot of shows are big because they're on Netflix. It's not that people subscribe to Netflix, they want to watch a show. The show gets big because it's on Netflix. And so now you have this feedback loop and the power is shifting towards Netflix, right? Where you just want your content. If you're a content producer, you want to get it on Netflix because that's where it's going to become a hit.
Yeah, right?
As opposed to the other way around where Netflix is like, I need this important content so I can sell subscriptions, right? And so when Disney Plus was preparing to come out, and Netflix in the beginning of 2019, you know, basically took like 2 years of price increases. It was like 15%, I think, average ARPU increase, something like that, because they knew Disney was coming. And they were like, we don't want to increase prices, you know, right after Disney launches, right? But man, how amazing that you can say competitive threats coming. Let's just jack our prices, you know, dramatically now. And I mean, wow, talk about preparing for yourself, right? And then when Disney Plus came along, the stock did really, you know, pretty weak in 2019 and as that kind of threat came along. And Disney Plus has been an amazing success. I mean, it's like seeming like every family with kids has Disney Plus. I mean, their subscriber numbers are off the charts. Now, they did a lot of that through just basically giving it away for free, right?
Yeah.
But still, it's still out there. They have these huge subscriber numbers. And yet it's like been immaterial in terms of churn for Netflix, right? I mean, you can't exactly attribute what's going on, but our estimates are 5% or less of people that subscribe to Disney Plus cancel a Netflix subscription, right? Hmm. And so what that means is that Disney was a complement, not a competitive threat to Netflix. And so if Disney launched the bazooka to attack Netflix and failed to dent Netflix, that tells you something very important about Netflix. So we talk about like moat attacks, right? When one of the best indicators of a moat is when somebody launches a competitive threat and it is a well-resourced, well-executed competitive attack and it fails, right? So Disney Plus didn't fail for Disney. It failed to crush Netflix in any meaningful way. Yep. And we think they're both going to do great over time. We are not negative on Disney Plus at all. They're making all the right moves. What they're doing is the playbook that Netflix laid out in the past.
Yeah.
They're making it cheap initially, they're flooding it with content, they're getting it out there. They're just following the Netflix playbook because Disney recognized, gosh darn it, Netflix isn't playing the right playbook and now we have to play catch up, right? Yeah. What's HBO Max doing now, right? I mean, I just got new iPhones and they're like, "Oh, by the way, you get HBO Max for free for a year." Oh, okay. Great, you know, but yeah. that's the right move, right? Because now I've been poking around. I wouldn't have before, but now I'm poking around, right?
Yeah.
So everybody else is desperate for scale. And what's Netflix doing? They've already conquered the US. They're going crazy internationally, right? Yeah. And just, you know, growing the content there. And so, you know, John Malone, the cable cowboy, years ago now was like, it's already too late. Global scale media, Netflix has already won. You know, and he was one of the potential competitors, you know, and I know he says different things at different times and stuff like that. But, you know, it's not that we don't worry about competitive threats. It's that the big bazooka was fired in the form of Disney Plus and it failed to hurt Netflix. Now, I know people will say, well, just wait, they're going to have more content later. Maybe so. Right. We aren't sitting there thinking, no, there's no company that's invincible. You know, we think they are very well positioned to maintain their hold, and there will be competition. But this is not like a winner take all where there's only one streaming service and that's only everybody uses, right? Of course, we're going to have multiple services. And so our view is just that Netflix will be the first service that every home has, and that you may have other services in addition to that, but you always have Netflix.
Yeah, Netflix is the new core.
Exactly.
Yeah. I have massive love for John Malone. He has taught me a lot. Indirectly through YouTube and whatnot. And I'm really happy that I found him. But I do think that they have a bit of a weak spot when it comes to looking out. For instance, I was listening to them talk about Spotify with SiriusXM. And I understand why they have a bias towards current free cash flow. I mean, they sort of run Liberty like a private equity shop might, except they have a perpetual ownership. But I do think that sometimes that causes a bit of either a discounting of strategy that's different or saying this doesn't make sense when it actually sort of does. The incentives are just quite a bit different from the other player on the field. So I don't know. That'll be interesting. One of the things that I've really enjoyed you speaking about is First Republic as a customer service entity as opposed to a bank. I think following your thought process, what's very cool about how you see the world or positions that you take, at least my perception of it, is you tend to see something, you frame the business in a different light than what people perceive the business to be. Is that a fair characteristic, do you think?
I mean, not in every case, but we definitely, if you think about like businesses that you like to find or the kind of patterns that you're looking for, and Todd coined the phrase idiosyncratic businesses, and in terms of that being what we're looking for, right? I mean, not that he coined idiosyncratic business for anybody, but in terms of that's a vocabulary that we use, right? In talking about the businesses that we talk about, that we had not previously used. And so, you know, many of the businesses that we invest in, you can pull up a list of their competitors, you know, like on Bloomberg, and just say, oh, this is their peer group, right? But that they are doing something fundamentally different than everybody else, right?
Yeah.
And it is, and that's what we're looking for, because what we're looking for are businesses that have competitive advantages. And if you're doing something nobody else is doing, right, and there's some reason why other people can't do it, then that's the recipe for a great business, right? And so in First Republic's case, you know, as a regional bank, I'm kind of the view that, like, you know, banks aren't really competitive advantage. They buy and sell money. It's the ultimate commodity, right? And yeah, of course, the giant banks have different advantages by virtue of their size. I mean, just the whole concept of too big to fail tells you something, right? But those entities have such, you know, opaque balance sheets that it's zero interest in investing in them for the most part. But with First Republic, you know, this was, you know, somebody else had pointed out and said, this isn't a bank, it's a customer service retail franchise. And I was like, what does that mean? But it was intriguing enough that I had to go poke around and figure it out. And so the easiest way to understand it is you say, well, great customer service, right? And in a lot of businesses like retail or restaurants, things like that, like that's table stakes. It's not a competitive advantage to offer great customer service. Everybody offers great customer service. But the banking industry is not known for having customers that love them.
Right? Yeah,
and,
this is
true. We saw a poll from Gallup a couple years ago in which they showed that only 30 or 40% of bank employees banked at the bank that they worked at, right?
Yeah, I don't think I banked at BMO when I was there.
And so, you know, even the employees are not saying this is the best bank for me. And so First of all, the whole thing is they are catering to high net worth individuals who value their time over an extra couple basis points of yield. Right.
Yeah.
And so when I, after doing the work, you know, I know a lot of people say they find products that they like and they go invest in the business. I tend to be the opposite. I tend to find a business that does something great, and then suddenly I start buying their products. Like I got into lawn care after I, you know, did
Scott's
Miracle-Gro. And after that, I was like, gosh, my lawn's a disaster. And I started doing all this stuff. And so the First Republic, I learned after we bought the stock, I was like, why am I with this bank if this First Republic has great customer service? And so, you know, one of the reasons, one of the pain points of switching banks is setting up your online bill pay again, right? And so I did that at First Republic, but one of them just wasn't kind of working right, and couldn't get it to work. And so my old bank, I would have had to call an 800 number, stay on hold for like 20 minutes, talk to someone who might not know what they're talking about, probably get transferred to somebody else, told I was in the wrong department, and then basically, you know, said, okay, you do these things and then hope that it works, right? With First Republic, I just emailed Rachel. I didn't email an 800 number, I didn't call anyone. It was Rachel. Rachel's my private banker. She's been my private banker ever since I first started with First Republic. So I emailed Rachel and said, hey, Rachel, I have a problem with this online bill pay setup. What should I do? Who do I call? And she emailed back like 20 minutes later and said, check now, it should be fixed. So I checked and it was fixed. That's why I bank with First Republic. That's why people love First Republic, right? So their net promoter scores, right? Kind of the gold standard, or, I mean, the best way to manage your, you know, customer satisfaction. Banks are super low. They're there with like telecom, like Comcast. Some of their approval ratings are like on the par with Congress, right? First Republic's net promoter scores, it's like Ritz-Carlton, Apple, Amazon. I mean, it's just, there's something they're doing very different, right?
Yeah.
You know, they've grown organically. They were the first bank to ever grow without acquisition to over 100 billion. They were founded in 1984, 85 in San Francisco. And they're still a pretty small bank in the grand scheme of things, right? But they're the number two bank in San Francisco. So, you know, living here, working here, we got a lot of clients here because we work with a lot of private clients, and everybody loves First Republic. Everybody. That's just weird for a bank. So that was the idiosyncratic nature of what we were capturing, right? And so, you know, they've been able to grow their deposits at about 15% of their loan book, 15, 20% per year for many, many years. And anyone who's a bank investor knows you don't want to be in a high growth bank because they're taking too much credit risk. Because how else could they be growing quickly, right?
Yeah.
Give away loans to people who can't afford to pay them back. That's how you grow fast, right? And First Republic actually has the best credit metrics, right? I mean, it's unbelievable, but it's way better than all the big banks, right? And so how do you grow fast with great credit quality? You're doing something different, and that's the customer service.
Yeah. That's very cool. Did you have early in your career, like, were you always sort of drawn to this quality? You also talk about stakeholder, like, you know, stakeholder capitalism. I've heard you talk about, have you always been into that, or did you make mistakes in some sort of value traps that, like, what brought you around to this way of looking at the world?
So I got into, like, started working professionally in investment business in 1999. And so the only reason that I didn't get caught up in kind of dot-com boom sorts of stuff is all I'd ever done was read about investing, right? And all I'd read was people like Warren Buffett. And yeah. So I naively was like, well, clearly this is a stock market bubble and I have to participate. Not because I had any insight at all, just because I was like, well, the PE is over 15, therefore it's overvalued, done, right? Yeah. And it was just a classic know-nothing, you know, statistical deep value investor. And then when I say know nothing, I mean as a 22-year-old, right? Who just says, well, low PE is all you need to know sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
And but I came kind of initially from kind of the value investment kind of view of the world. But Kurt, who I joined, was just more growth oriented. He was always, you know, sensitive on price and everything like that. And I think that from when I started working with him up until maybe around 2010, 2011, while we were seeking out businesses that had competitive advantages and all of that, you might have described our strategy as more like a GARP strategy. And then I feel like the financial crisis, if you managed money through that time, there had to have been some big lesson you learned, right? If you survived it, you have to be able to look back and think about what did we learn? What should we do differently? And so, you know, in 2008, 2009, and coming out in 2010, I just kind of took a deep breath and you know, said, I went back and revisited lots of stuff I'd read early on in my career and said, okay, I got some experience under my belt. And, you know, what do I know? And I've been doing this and I survived this disaster, you know? And really what stuck out to me was that these businesses that have competitive advantages, they are able to control their own destiny in a way that other companies are not able to. And having gone through the financial crisis and seen something totally out of companies' control come along like a tsunami, you recognize you need to be the ones that have some control over their destiny, right? And it may be a limited, we are all subject to uncertainty. The world, I think, is way more uncertain than most investors appreciate, you know? Yeah. And yet to outperform the S&P 500, to generate some good long-term returns, you just need to have companies that are more able to control their destiny. They don't have to have complete control over their destiny, you know? And so just that really started leaning into that. And so today, when we talk about our strategy, you know, competitive advantage is the unifying narrative behind every single one of our holdings. That's what we invest in. We look for businesses that are deeply competitively advantaged. We own a title insurance company that trades at 8x earnings, and we own Netflix, right? So we're not growth, we're not value. I don't care about low PE, high PE. I care about competitively advantaged business and be able to buy their stock for a price that is less than the present value of the cash flow that company is going to produce over the long term. And so to me, we're value investors, right? Because we only buy something for less than we think it's worth. And when we think about intrinsic value, we just mean cash flows. That's all you get as a shareholder, right?
Yeah.
Is the distributable cash flow of that business, right? And so we're value investors in that every company in our portfolio trades at a price below what we think those future cash flows are going to be. Now, something like Netflix, I mean, we were wrong, of course, right? But we don't own it because we think, hey, they're going to have a great couple quarters and we can sell it to somebody else at 600, right? It's that we just think they're going to produce tons of cash flow well in excess of their market cap.
Yeah. And I think that the margin of safety, I mean, you know, I guess the cash flow focus that's sort of like the Bible, right? For me is Buffett's, this is what you get when, you know, you get the present value of all your cash flows. And that is what enables the second way out on a lot of these things, where if the stock goes against you, it just doesn't matter. And that's the one thing that, like, the code of the value investor that I hope that, you know, everybody actually sort of understands, because that is the foundational basis. Now, you know, it gets hard when you're parsing, okay, well, what's growth spend and what's maintenance spend? I have a lot of problems with some of these SaaS companies because the cohort build and the land and expand, and that it seems to me like perpetually expanding SG&A, but I at least recognize that there are a lot of people that don't have those constraints around them and that they're doing rational things. I used to say, I'm not going to go anywhere near any of that stuff. Just give me cheap things. And then I found that I was touching stoves. And since I have oriented, you know, my way of thinking towards closer to the way that you look at the world, I still mess around and touch Wells Fargo occasionally and stuff like that. But I owe a lot to Manual of Ideas. I owe a lot to FinTwit for pivoting the way that I look at the world. And, you know, we'll see. I guess a skeptic would say, well, everything is bounced. So how much of it's brains and how much of it's a bull market? But I think it's closer to the right strategy than not. It's the only strategy I'll implement from here on out.
The thing is it doesn't matter what you call yourself, if you're a value investor, growth investor, anything else. If you are a long-term investor, right, where you're buying companies and you're the mechanism by which you are expecting to make money is through the corporate performance of the companies you invest in, not because you're trying to arbitrage stock price moves, right, but because you're trying to participate in the value generation of the corporations in which you are a shareholder, right? If that is your strategy, it doesn't matter what you call yourself or kind of what style you use. You recognize that you then have to pay a price that is less than what those future cash flows are going to be. And if you look at something like, say, the price to book multiple that, you know, was a popular form of value investing for a long time and has failed for a long time, that was just a proxy for understanding current price versus future cash flows.
Yeah.
Once upon a time, in a tangible asset world, book value was a rather good way to create a stable estimate of future returns. So if you look at like the ROE on a company that's tangible book value sort of company, well, you build that book, that's how you keep growing earnings, right? And so that made a lot of sense, you know. But it never meant the book value was relevant. Book value is only relevant when you're going bankrupt. I don't ever want to have a claim on book value on a company, right? I mean, yeah. It's in theory, we own some pro rata portion of it, but I sure hope I don't get it ever, right?
Yeah, things have gone horribly wrong.
Yeah, exactly, right? And so we're trying to invest in businesses that don't have a chance of going bankrupt. So I don't really feel like I need a margin of safety on their balance sheet to cover me if they do go bankrupt. I've made a huge mistake and we're going to be out of a stock, hopefully well before we're getting any claim on book value. But that doesn't mean that book value is irrelevant, right? So in banks and insurers, it's still a very relevant metric. Give me a break. Of course it is, because these are tangible asset businesses, right? And so, I think that the key thing is just understanding that when people say value investing has not worked for a long time, what they're really saying is the proxies that we used to use for evaluating these things no longer are good proxies.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Or they're just due for a monster comeback. But I think the world's changed a lot. And those proxies, the ones that have failed, are going to keep failing because they're not good proxies of businesses today. But that doesn't mean they're bad in every instance, you know. And so the challenging thing is it's hard for investors to accept that what they're owning is something in the future and that future is unpredictable. And so because we hate uncertainty, we create a proxy for the future and we substitute with something current that we can look at and see. And we say, oh, there you go. There's my value. Look, it's, you know, 15 times earnings. That's cheap. But those earnings, those are yesterday's earnings. You don't get a piece of those. You get tomorrow's cash flow, right?
Yep.
And so I think that's the key thing is recognizing their proxies. Proxies are super useful, but they are not what, don't substitute them for your real goal, right?
Yeah. When you own something like Heiko or TransDigm, and I'm not trying to ask about them specifically. I'm more thinking about the idea of serial acquirers. How do you think through underwriting the acquisitions, right? And how much of the value is accretive and when it's going to occur, you know, just high level. How do you think through that stuff?
So when we first invested in TransDigm, if you had looked at it and assumed no acquisitions, it looked like it was an expensive stock. But TransDigm is pretty much like a private equity company, right? And so imagine buying a private equity company, but assuming there was no more deals they were ever going to do.
Yeah.
that's what they do, right? I mean, like, it doesn't make any sense.
That's not exactly
right?
Reality.
Yeah. And so with TransDigm, we made a forecast of how much they were going to spend on M&A and the returns they were going to generate on that M&A and how it would play out over time. And so just like anyone investing in a company that doesn't do M&A, you're going to forecast what your CapEx is or your growth spend or whatever it is. This was just the mechanism which TransDigm was doing that, right? And it was clearly an ongoing strategic part of what they did. That was their business, is their business, right? And so we modeled in future M&A. At the time, it was the only company that we had ever done that with. But we had never really thought about like a roll-up. That's a nasty word in our shop back then, you know. And it's like, you know, the roll-ups, this is, I don't want to look at a roll-up, right? And,
yeah.
And so, but then understanding, well, no, you know, this is their business model, right? And no one calls Berkshire Hathaway a roll-up.
Yeah, right?
You know, and so You know, today we are generally quite cautious to model M&A. If you think about like the base rate on M&A for all companies, it's not good, right? Yeah. And so if we don't model M&A, like we have companies that we know are going to do some M&A, by not modeling it, all we're really doing is assuming that they're going to earn their cost of capital on that M&A. Because if you earn your cost of capital on the M&A that you do, it is no different than, say, paying it out to shareholders or buying back your share price at fair value or whatever it might be. So for us, it's like, this is just a real cash flow. Yeah. So when we explicitly are modeling M&A, what we're doing is, oh, they have this ability to reinvest cash into M&A at higher rates of return, right? Than just like kicking it back to us as a dividend so we can go reinvest it in our strategy mm-hmm. or something, right? And so that's pretty rare when you can find a company that can systematically over and over again at a level and size that makes it a material different, can keep doing that. And it's part of their ongoing business model. But when that's the case, well, you'd be silly to ignore it, right? And so that's how we go about doing that. It's important though, if you're modeling this for, you know, people that are analysts and as technical, is recognizing that that's going to get reinvested at the returns that they earn on their M&A, not the kind of returns on invested capital that maybe their core business is doing. And it's typically going to be lower, right?
Yeah.
And so understanding those differences is important. But, you know, we own Broadridge Financial, and on their investor day today, they pointed out that they've added 2% to revenue growth for the last 6 years running, and they calculated 19% IRR on that M&A investment. And we think that's generally about correct. And yeah, that's a value creative, you know, behavior for them. And they're very likely to keep doing that.
When do you think through, because you and I have talked about a name offline that you, like you had said, well, they only grow through M&A and not organic growth. But how do you decide, like, this is not a name that I'm comfortable with the acquisition side driving the growth because the organic growth isn't there? If there's no organic growth, is it just a non-starter for you?
Well, let's throw TransDigm out. I think TransDigm is a special case and this complex sort of situation and everything. But in general, we want the core business to have its own kind of ongoing sustainable organic growth rate, and that M&A should be on top of that, really, you know?
Yeah.
And so we've written about kind of low growth risk that most investors think about high growth companies as being risky companies, right? And a company that grows, you know, 3% every year feels like it might not be, you know, the grand slam, but this is a safe stock, right? And it's not risky. But as we've shown in some of our publications, right? So if your long-term growth rate is 3%, not 4%, there is a huge impact to valuation, right? 2% versus 4%. Oh my gosh, look out below, right? And so when you're making a forecast for a stock and you say to yourself, well, it can grow 4% per year for, you know, a decade or more. What if you're wrong and it's only 3%? That's a very thin margin of error. So margin of safety becomes a real issue because you have to be forecasting down to 1 percentage point differentials in growth rates make a difference, right? And so we just kind of as a rule are looking for businesses that we think can grow organically at or above nominal GDP, basically in perpetuity, right? And obviously perpetuity is a very long time, right? But I mean, you know, for the foreseeable future, right?
Yeah.
And because if they get below that, we think of it, we call it stall speed. It's this idea that like basically you're losing share of GDP. If you're growing slower than GDP, you are losing market share, right? You're losing, market share is the wrong word, wallet share of total GDP, which what mm-hmm. that means is it means you're becoming less and less relevant to the economy. And we don't want to invest in businesses that have declining relevance, right? We want companies that are investing that have persistent and maybe even increasing relevance. And so, you know, stall speed is this idea that when a plane hits stall speed, you crash, right? And so when you run the risk, once you start coasting at a growth rate slower than the economy, you're right at that stall speed. And maybe you aren't. If you could tell me, like, treasury bonds don't grow, but I could value that, no problem, because it's guaranteed at a certain rate. That's fine, right? But most companies can't guarantee a low growth rate forever.
Well, I think that where a couple of these concepts can come together is if you're at your stall speed and you have a management that is incented to grow earnings or something like that, there is a real possibility that they try to do so by mortgaging their moat. And then you start to get into this sort of like negative cycle where, you know, you'd look at a consumer product company that you guys wrote about. When was that? Was that 2018 or 2017 when you first highlighted that you thought that there was risk in that?
I think it must have been, that was Prestige Brands, and I think that was 2018, right?
Yeah. I think that's right. Yeah. Now, you know, they had your thesis was somewhat different, right? It was distribution barriers are eroding, right? And there's going to be increased competition. But I think everything is a confluence, like Charlie Munger's Lollapalooza effect, right? Where it's like everything starts to work against you all of a sudden if you're hitting stall speed, as opposed to if you've got that momentum, you can do things like Netflix is doing, where you're underpricing your product and you're delivering joy to your consumer. Yeah. And then, you know, it's just like a virtuous cycle, right? So aligning yourselves on treadmills that are going the right way are probably a pretty smart strategy in life.
I think for us, I hope it's smart. Most importantly, it fits our personality as investors. And so it works for us, right? Yeah. But most people don't want to be investing in super low growth or declining businesses, right? And that suggests to me that there is a great opportunity for other investors who are wired differently and think differently to go make money in those stocks. It's just, yeah, we're not going to make money in those stocks, right? And so we have to play in the area where we think we are competitively advantaged, right? And so, you know, we're not, in theory, every company has a value, but, you know, every company could be a good investment, but not for us. We have a very limited set of companies that I think we have any capabilities to analyze, understand, and then own for 5 years, for 10 years, for 15 years, and not get shaken out at the wrong time.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think that the tough thing when you're on one of those that's at stall speed, to your point, is if you then like really stall, how are you the guy that's not shaken out or girl that's not shaken out at the wrong time, right? Because it gets very hard to decipher. Thesis creep can be a very real thing. It's real everywhere, right? But when you're in that situation, it can get very difficult. I read something that you wrote about position sizing, and I really liked how you framed this. And you said, if somebody offered you 2-to-1 odds that the sun would come up tomorrow, you should make that a much larger bet than if someone offers you 1,000-to-1 that it will rain tomorrow. And from a portfolio standpoint, that's a very, very smart thought, sir. I give you mad props for saying that. It may not, you know, quite be as prophetic as I thought it was, but it changed the way that I really thought about stuff.
You know, when I said that coming out of the financial crisis, you know, just kind of revaluing what we did, what lessons did we learn, I spent a long time really focused on position sizing and trying to think about it. And what I found frustrating, but then also curious and interesting, and why I became so passionate about it, is there is very little written about position sizing. So all day, every day, CNBC, people come along and tell you what to buy, where it's going. Nobody tells you how much.
Yeah, by the way, it's 30 basis points in my portfolio.
Yeah, and they will never recommend it, right? And you look for books. There's a ton of books out there, how to pick stocks. There's how to short stocks. They never tell you how much to buy, right?
Yeah.
And so the Kelly Criterion is, you know, everyone holds this up. And the Kelly Criterion is a fantastic mathematical kind of philosophy around position sizing. And for listeners that don't know, the kind of Kelly Criterion basically was about blackjack betting, and basically was this way to understand that what you cared about was not only what the payoff is going to be, right? Which is what everyone focuses on Wall Street, how much the stock's going to go up, but also how likely you were to be right. And the Kelly Criterion demonstrates mathematically that it is the likelihood of being correct that is far bigger driver of how big your bet should be or your position size should be than what the upside is. And so the analogy that kind of, you know, because I know the sun's going to come up tomorrow, I would bet my life savings for a 2-to-1 payoff that the sun's going to come up tomorrow.
Yeah.
But because it may or may not rain tomorrow, no matter what the forecasts say, I have to make a much smaller bet, even if the payoff's really large, because I can't risk ruin, right? Yeah. I can't get wiped out on a bet that might not play off, right? And so what that speaks to is that position sizing should be driven far more by the likelihood that you will be correct than by how much you'll make, right?
Yeah.
If you are correct. They're both important, but that's the key piece. The problem with the Kelly Criterion is that to use that formula, you actually have to know what those odds are.
Yep.
And as investors, we do not know the likelihood that we will be right. We do not know what the payoff will be if we are right, right? And what will happen if we aren't right. None of that is knowable. And so therefore, you can't just, you know, plug in these estimates into the formula and get your answers, right? But philosophically, that's informed what we did. And you know, going into kind of this evaluation, we had always run about 20 to 25 securities in our portfolio. And then kind of lo and behold, as I did more and more research, I kind of realized, well, there was a whole lot of academic and practitioner evidence that that's actually the sweet spot, right? That if you build a portfolio of randomly selected stocks, and you have 5 stocks in your portfolio and you go to 10, you will greatly reduce the volatility of your portfolio really significantly and greatly reduce the risk of ruin, right?
Yeah.
But as you get out towards 2025 and get towards 30, the incremental benefit is super tiny, right? And so that research that was first done for the book Random Walk Down Wall Street was written by somebody who believed in efficient market hypothesis like full bore. And so Bernd Malkiel was like, so therefore you just keep adding diversification because, I mean, it's a free lunch, right? But I don't have 100 good ideas. Yeah. I don't think anybody does. The average mutual fund owns 150 securities. I mean, how could you care enough about those companies to do the work that we do to really understand something if you don't even have 100 basis points in your portfolio, right? Yeah. I mean, we live and breathe the companies that we own because we own them in size, right? But I'm given comfort by the fact that I know that by owning the number that we own, there's no reason we should be any more volatile than the market overall. And our track record suggests exactly that, right? So it's not just the theory, but it's actually in practice, you know? And the one key thing is, remember, that was from randomly selected securities, and we don't select them randomly. So you have to be very careful if you are an active manager running a focused portfolio that you don't have too many securities that are overly correlated to each other. And we don't think about that correlation as a stock market correlation. We think about it as demand correlation, right? So we did analysis where you have a number of stocks that are kind of in the housing industry in one way or another. And we've done some analysis and said, like, they just don't actually trade as closely together as you would think. And the reason is they're all in different demand cycles, right? Like, yeah. New housing doesn't go the same patterns as home improvement, which doesn't go in the same way as installing services, right? And so you can participate in a concentration in an industry so long as the drivers are different, right? And so we hope, and I think our track record suggests, that we have plenty of diversification in kind of end market demand within our portfolio. Despite the fact that sometimes our sector allocations can seem like super overweight or super underweight. Like we've owned a lot of industrials and you think, oh, but they must be long a ton of factories and stuff, but a lot of them are business service stocks serving totally different businesses, right? And so they're not correlated and it's not really a concentrated bet on industrials.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I don't know. I came in a traditional value way and, you know, cheap stuff. And then I realized, after a little while, I call myself, I've been a professional for maybe 4 years, right? And the other years were just me trying to figure out all the stupid stuff not to do anymore. And I realized a lot of the stuff that I owned had completely, you know, it may have looked like 12 separate bets, but at the end of the day, the correlation was super high on that. And I finally asked myself, I said, well, what am I so afraid of paying up for some of these better businesses? And then it was sort of, you know, it became, well, I'll add 1 to the portfolio, right? And then I'll add 2 to the portfolio. And then I realized, oh, my portfolio is performing much better because there's actually diversification in the portfolio, right? I'm getting the portfolio benefits of being in different. It sounds so stupid to say out loud because it's clearly what the research shows. But behaviorally, I had been so ingrained to avoid paying up that I think that I was taking way more risk than I appreciated at the time, which is, you know, part of why I started down this journey was to, I had inherited some money and I didn't control all of it. And I said, well, I have to figure out how to run a small amount before I can be responsible for, more, right? And I'm glad that I didn't inherit it earlier because I probably would have blown it on a bunch of correlated bets going into 2008. So I'd have been in a lot of the things that blew up because they were cheap, right?
Yeah. So before we go on, let's dig a little bit more into conviction and position sizing because conviction is a phrase people throw around a lot. Like, I've got a lot of conviction in this stock, which may just mean it's gone up a whole lot and I love it, right? And when it goes back down, I don't have conviction in this stock anymore, right? So when I say conviction, I don't just mean that we love a company. What I mean is that we rate all of our holdings across 7 different elements on conviction, our confidence that we are right about that element of the business. And so that is the strength of their moat. How confident are we that whatever we think the moat is can protect them from competition? And then the ongoing long-term, like decade plus relevance of their product. How confident are we that this company's products or services will be as or more relevant in the future than they are today. And then we look at management and we want to understand how confident are we that they are going to be able to create value for their customers, right? Create value for all of their stakeholders and create value for us as shareholders. We think, you know, that you can look at management teams just through each of those lens. And some of them will score well on some aspects, right? Like, I mean, TransDigm's like shareholder max, right? You can have some big arguments on how do they think about stakeholders overall, and maybe it's a lot lower, right? And so you have to look at these differently. You have conviction in different elements of it. And then we think about kind of how intrinsically forecastable a business is, right? So like a consumer products CFO can tell you what the next 5-year price increases were going to be and be accurate within a couple percentage points. But an honest oil CFO is, E&P CFO is not going to tell you what the price of oil is in the next 5 years, right? Yeah. They'll be off by a lot, right? So some businesses are intrinsically more forecastable, right? And then there's just our own circle of competence, right? How well are we positioned to understand this? And so we have a threshold level for every company in our portfolio to reach a certain threshold on all of those. And then within our portfolio, we force rank everything on those, which is a really tough thing. It's where you're picking between your kids, right? Like we love all of our holdings. Otherwise, we would not own them. Right. If we didn't love a holding, it's out of the portfolio. Right. And so we love all of them, but we force rank all of them on each of those questions. Right. And then we're able to develop a quantitative score of conviction. And so when the stock starts going down and we get worried, right, we don't just say like, well, I've lost conviction. I think we should lower the position size. If we get worried, we go look at our ratings and we understand like where is the worry? It's probably not on all 7 issues. It's probably in certain issues, right? And then we zero in on that and say like, are we actually have less conviction on that versus our other companies, or is it just like this is what exactly is going on? So as an example, owning Booking Holdings during a global pandemic is scary, right? Yeah. And they had negative revenue in April of this year, right? Yeah. Our conviction in the forecastability, it declined significantly, and it's still lower than what it was pre-pandemic because we do not have as much confidence in what global travel patterns are going to be like over the next 5 years. If anybody thinks that they are as confident on what global travel patterns are going to be in the next 5 years versus what they were pre-pandemic, they're crazy, right? Yeah. So our conviction, that element of booking lower, not because we got scared, but because, hey, realistically, we don't know, right? Yeah. But we also were like, but humans, our DNA impels us to travel. That is why humans have covered the entire globe, right? And so we are certain that it's going to come back at some point, right? And so we kind of look at these different elements. But at the end of the day, even printing negative revenue, we were like, hey, the core things are all here, right? And we had to make sure, can they get to the other side? That was our big analysis starting in March, was every business has to survive to be a long-term winner, right?
Yeah.
And Booking, which, we did our own analysis and they validate when they came out in April and said basically, hey, look, everybody, we've raised some more cash. The market's only making us pay 4% for this new debt. They're making Airbnb at the time pay 11%, Expedia 11%, but they're giving it to us for 4%. Right? Kind of amazing. We have negative revenue and the market's lending us money at 4%. That's how confident the market is, debt market is in us. And guess what? We could have no revenue through the end of 2021 and we can still operate, right? That is an incredibly resilient business, right? So for Booking, 60% of their cost structure pre-pandemic was through marketing, but you don't need to do any marketing when there's no demand.
Yeah.
So those costs just shut off along with the revenue opportunity, right? And so they had the ability to greatly reduce their cost structure in the face of very, very, very weak demand, but we were able to have our conviction, even though we were scared like any sensible person was in April, because there was nothing in our conviction ratings where we'd say, yep, that's actually all that, a disqualifying level of, a low rating, right? That is too low for us. Right. And so really, I think that for us, that's become kind of the lodestar, right? Is that we understand quantitatively what our convictions are in business. And we might be wrong, but that then allows us to quantitatively create position sizes. So there is no discussion. I'm the CIO, but there's no discussion. I don't ever say, let's hold Netflix through earnings and see how it does. And or maybe we should lighten up. Those discussions don't happen in Ensemble.
Do you have a devil's advocate? Sorry.
Let me talk about devil's advocate in a second. But so we don't, when we talk about trading, it is that the formula that we use for position sizing, that's a function of conviction plus upside appreciation, kind of Kelly inspired, is calling for a certain position size, and we are going to drive our portfolios towards that position size. And to the extent that it feels wrong to us as, hopefully informed discretionary managers, right? We don't just say, well, let's just feel differently about it. We say, what's wrong with our model, right? And we dig into that and understand, what are we feeling? And sometimes we recognize, we haven't captured something in our formulaic model. It's just a model, right? And so it's not reality, right? And so then we might adjust our model, which we do from time to time, you know, or we recognize that we got to change these scores because we didn't appreciate something. And other times we just realize, nope, it's telling us to trim and we just don't feel like it, right? but we're going to go with what we know is the right path to do. So we actually have a very quantitatively implemented position sizing framework, which is the total opposite of the very, very, very qualitative work we do on competitive advantage analysis. But I think that's right, because I think humans are way better than computers at understanding competitive advantages. But computers are way better than humans at understanding the statistical position sizing that you should own based on that qualitative input. So for us, it's about, let's let the computer do what it's good at. We do what we're good at, you know, and that's been the right match for us.
Lives up to your name, sir. An ensemble of things working together.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. You asked about devil's advocate.
Just to make sure that you didn't fall in love with your quantitative ratings, right? If the three of you sort of like the business, I mean, do you put somebody in the room to shred it to pieces or say, no way, it doesn't deserve that quantitative rating. You're too in love with it.
So it is a good thing that me and RF and Todd enjoy each other's company so much, because we argue all day, every day. Like that's like basically what we do, you know? I mean, it's incredible. Now, if any analyst on our team believes that a company in our portfolio doesn't meet a threshold level of conviction in any one of the areas, we will argue about it. But if they don't yield, it's out of the portfolio, right? So this is not managed by consensus, right? We're not all deciding, oh, we all have to be in. But if there's any aspect where someone's like, guys, this doesn't even meet our threshold level, because we're only looking for 20, 25 stocks, right? So if someone on the team is like pulling the ripcord, well, go find something else, right? Yeah. It's like return on brain damage sort of issue, right? Just go find something different, right? But we all have our own ratings, right? And we review them regularly. And when they are different from each other, we kind of dig into why that is and we debate it. And we sometimes will recognize, oh, one person wasn't thinking about that question the same way somebody else was. And then maybe both our views get enhanced and we might change or not change our ratings, but they've been improved, right? And other times we say, we're all looking at the same facts. We just have different opinions, and that is fine, right? And so we kind of roll those up and act on that. We don't have a formal devil's advocate kind of concept, right? So for listeners, like basically the idea that somebody on the team should be in charge of kind of figuring out the bear case and advocating for the bear case. I think the problem with that approach is that everybody knows that's the devil's advocate. And so everyone's kind of like, well, I can kind of dismiss that because they're just doing their job, right?
Yeah, they have to do this.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so it can really create, I think, an environment of confrontation. And I know there's some businesses, some investors that have thrived through environments of confrontation. We argue a lot, but it is not an emotional confrontation. There is no yelling at Ensemble, right? There is no name calling at Ensemble, right? I mean, we have passionate discussions about how we view the world. And we recognize that the other people on the team with us are there in that seat because their point of view is just as valid as the other person's, including mine. It doesn't matter that I'm a CIO. There's nothing about my point of view that is somehow more enlightened or, you know, I don't have any better view of reality than other people on my team. I just have my view of reality, right? And so, you know, the idea of setting somebody up as being kind of the fall guy, right? That you say, well, I don't have to worry about the risks for me because they got that covered. And since they're the risk person, then I can ignore them, right? Hmm. So we're all responsible for those risks. But we absolutely, you know, challenge each other on different things, and we absolutely have different opinions. And you know, one of us is the lead analyst on every name, including myself. I know there's CIOs who aren't actually analysts, but to me, this would be a boring job if I didn't cover stocks. I mean, that's kind of why I got into the business, right? And so we each cover about a third of the portfolio as the lead analyst. But they're just the lead, right? And so, you know, leads can often kind of fall in love with the company a little bit, and that's a good thing. We want to love our company. But it's the job of all of ours to challenge each other. And so every quarter, every company, there's something that we don't like, right? I mean, if you think a company printed a perfect quarter, you're not paying attention.
Yeah. It's interesting. Well, I like that approach. We're coming up on time. So my last question before I let you go, errors of omission, what's one that really, really grinds your gears?
You know, I was asked this question recently, and I know that people say this like, oh, it's this, you know, errors of omission are more important than errors of commission. But if you're investing in 20 to 25 stocks, you miss a ton of stuff. That's by design. It's not a mistake. It's like, I mean, you know, people ask us all the time, well, why don't you own this? And the answer more often than not is because we've never done a deep dive on it. That's why. Right. Yeah. And I think that the it's not exactly an error of omission, but I think it gets at what you're asking about, is that, and it really kind of influenced how I think about valuing stocks and paying attention to different companies, is when Facebook bought Instagram for $1 billion, mm-hmm. and they had 17 employees and zero revenue, I thought to myself, I don't even have to research this deal. Clearly, mm-hmm. we're back in another bubble. This is a silly dot-com era sorts of things. You don't pay $1 billion for a company with no revenue. And clearly, I was terribly wrong, right? Mm-hmm. I just didn't know what I was talking about. But I told myself, I don't have to do the work because I already can tell that this is an idiotic move. But I mean, what a dumb thing to say. Facebook's a super successful company. Mark Zuckerberg is a brilliant individual. He wouldn't do something that was just obviously incorrect that you could tell without even doing real diligence on it, right? And so when I recognized over time that, like, gosh, I had such a naive, dumb reaction to that, and why was that? When I realized it just came down to I held an opinion despite not actually having done the work, right? And so, you know, we live in an environment right now where, you know, companies are going public and getting 100% pops on their IPO, and boy, is that a danger signal. Right. But I refuse to look at any of those companies and say to myself, I know they're overvalued. I mean, you know, there's companies out there selling like 200 times sales right now. And I mean, I think they're overvalued. Right. I would kind of, that'd be my guess. Yeah. But I don't know. And so therefore, I shouldn't have an opinion. We work way too hard to have the opinions that we have on our stocks in our portfolio for us to somehow seemingly be able to dismiss companies we haven't done any work on and say, I don't even need to do that. And so I think that the sin of omission for me was kind of thinking to myself, I don't have to pay attention to Facebook or Instagram because, gosh, this is just dumb stuff. And that was so clearly wrong. And I think that going forward, over time, it took me a while to figure this out, is just realizing this is one of the reasons why we don't look at valuation when we start looking at stocks. It's just say, mm-hmm. you don't know, right? So for us, we start to look at a stock because usually we hear something about them that is kind of unusual, kind of idiosyncratic, something that doesn't make sense, and something that relates to competitive advantages. And then we start digging a little bit, right? And we dig into that more and more. And, you know, we get asked by especially institutional investors, like, what's your process for idea generation? And I wish that I could tell them, well, we have this 6-step process and just go process it through. It's like a little factory here and stuff like that. But if that was the case, anyone else could do it too, right? Yeah. And so what we're doing is a much more organic process. And there is absolutely a repeatable system to what we do. Otherwise, we wouldn't keep coming up with new ideas, right? But it is a very organic process. And what it is that we're looking for something that other people look for completely managed businesses, of course, right? But that is our lodestar, right? And so what we're looking for is signals about that. So, you know, when getting back to First Republic, I didn't look at the stock price. I didn't look at their ROE. I just heard that this wasn't a bank. It was a customer service business. And that just was intriguing to me. And then I very quickly realized, they have customer service stats that make them look like the most loved companies in the world, and the banking industry has terrible stats. What is going on here? I hadn't looked at valuation yet. I hadn't looked at their growth rate. It's like, this is what gets me digging. This is what gets me excited, you know? And so, but I just have learned, don't have opinions on any stocks until you've actually done the work, right? And so I really should have, in retrospect, said, why'd they pay $1 billion for a company with no revenue? There must be something really interesting there, right?
Yeah.
And instead, I closed my mind to it, right? And I said, I don't even need to pay attention because it's obviously dumb. And I was the one who was dumb.
It's one of the best answers I've heard to that. And I'm not just blowing smoke. I did the same exact thing. And it triggered two thoughts for me. One, I quote him a lot because what he says makes sense to me. Adam Robinson once said to Tim Ferriss, he said, look in places that are like glaringly obvious and places that don't make any sense. So mm-hmm. if you see a headline and it's like perfectly obvious or just doesn't make any sense, dig, right? Don't form an opinion. And then the other one's like this old Tony Robbins, ask better questions to get better answers. But Sean, I really appreciated your time, man. I hope that that everybody listening has too. And I look forward to many conversations in the future.
Bill, thanks so much for having me. It's fun to have this sort of conversation as opposed to, you know, 20 minutes of kind of some stock questions and playing this all out and covering the ground we did. So best of luck on your podcast. I've really been enjoying them and look forward to hearing from a lot more people.
Thank you. Take care, man.
All right, Bill.